And so they're a little different. Some of the words may be a little, you know, but I'll try to explain any word I may use. Sometimes I make a slip and, you know, say a word that many people may not know, but it's all, you know, it's all very wonderful. Actually, Sanskrit is a very special language because every syllable represents a certain vibration that has a beneficial effect physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. It's a most ancient language on the planet. Of course, from our point of view, it actually comes from the spiritual realm. So, it's, anyway, I was thinking, I'm informal by nature, so I was thinking that we would have some questions, and maybe we can that way embark on some theme or some particular subject matter, because especially as when one is approaching or trying to understand something about our philosophy, Krishna consciousness, or call it Krishna consciousness, because we try to help people to understand that the actual purpose of our life, of our existence, is to be conscious of God. And Krishna is this very special name of God. God has unlimited names. And among those names, Krishna is considered to be very unique because it means the most attractive person, the most attractive object, the energy that pulls us all in to our original source. And so, and by definition, God should be that way. Sometimes we see him painted on the, you know, some chapel or painting as an old man with a beard, you know, and but actually we consider that he's the source of everything. If God is God, means the source of everything, source of beauty. So he must be the most beautiful, not an old man with a beard, but you know, the most beautiful person. The strongest person, the most intelligent person, the most famous person. Actually, he is famous because even both the theists and the atheists always talk about him. He's very, very popular, yeah. Very well known. And in every way, most renounced also. These are qualities that we appreciate generally. You know? I mean, you'll find that everybody appreciates these things. You know, you can find something unusual nowadays that some people appreciate. But these are things that everybody appreciates. So we talk about those qualities. Of course, the Supreme must have unlimited qualities, unlimited everything. So anyway, Krishna. So Krishna consciousness or God consciousness is the actual objective for human beings and for everyone. Of course, most animals have a hard time being very conscious of God because they're, you know, interested in quacking or barking or something else. But human beings, unfortunately, we're also interested in other things. And that's why we're here, to try to remind people that this is the main objective. And the reason for that is, and this is, Bhagavad Gita is our main book. Bhagavan means that person who possesses all these wonderful opulences or qualities that we just mentioned. And Gita, just like in Spanish, guitarra, you know, for musical. So that comes from Gita, which means to sing or to chant or to relate. So it means the song of God. And why is it a song? Because it's very poetic. You know, everything is rhyming and meter and very beautiful. Because when God speaks, it's very beautiful. You know, English is like a businessman's language, but Sanskrit is a spiritual language. So anyway, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago. And where did he speak it? Who remembers? So, do you remember where he spoke it? Yes, and what is clerkship, John?
I don't know.
A battlefield. It was a battlefield. Now, most people would think that, you know, for transmitting spiritual knowledge, a battlefield wouldn't be the best place. You know? If we were to choose, where are we going to have a sermon? You know, let's have it on the battlefield in the middle of a war. But the reason that Krishna chose that circumstance and that place was because all of us have trials and tribulations in our life. All of us have to confront difficulties, challenges. You know? And sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad, sometimes we're victorious, sometimes we're defeated. You know? That's the nature of life. So Krishna chose not only a battlefield, but a practically speaking, a fratricidal war, civil war, so to speak, between family members. And why did he choose that? Because that was a very difficult circumstance. So if that knowledge transmitted in such a difficult circumstance was applicable to his student, Arjuna, then it would be so much more applicable to us, where our battle is, you know, make a little more money or overcome some disease or, you know, go on with life or maintain my family or make some friends, whatever we're doing. You know, there's always a challenge. Everything requires some effort. And so the gist of Bhagavad Gita is to take those efforts, the expenditures of energy that we have to make every day, every moment, and convert them into something that's related to the Supreme, and thus maintaining our connection with the Supreme at all times. So that's Bhagavad Gita. And the first teaching of Bhagavad Gita is to understand the difference between the body and the soul. Generally speaking, what does everybody say? My soul. No? That just shows what we live in a society, in a world, in a realm where we think we're the body. No? We look in the mirror and think, that's me. No? And we say, my soul. But it's actually the reverse. I'm the soul, it's my body. So this is the first lesson that Krishna taught. Because if we don't know who we are, how can we understand who God is? This is the first lesson. And just like if you saw someone hopping down the street saying, I'm a rabbit, you know, what would you think? I think he's a little off-kilter, a little crazy. But actually, most of us are doing that. We're thinking that we're this body. So from Krishna's point of view, from the Supreme Lord's point of view, who is the source of all of us, and we are actually spiritual by nature, this is almost like a mental institution, you know, this world. And then we have mental institutions within the institution, you know. Different degrees of being a little disoriented. And some people are very disoriented. So, this is the first teaching of Bhagavad Gita, that we must understand the body is perishable. You know, even though I remember many years ago, I was in an airplane, and I leaf through the magazine just to see what people are thinking about, talking about. So, there was an article that says, you look very good for a man of 163. I thought, that's an interesting article. And I read it and said, yes, this technology is coming. And it had this whole scientific explanation, cellular regeneration, this and that. And then at the end it said, of course, this technology will probably not be ready in your lifetime, nor of your children or your grandchildren. But someday, you know, we are certain that it will be. And so, this is the promise that we're the carrot that's in being strung in front of us. That, yes, no, if I put on this cream, if I take this pill, if I eat these herbs, if I do this and I do that, I can be young forever. So Krishna is trying to teach us that This is not the objective of life. The objective is to understand who I am and act on that platform, the spiritual platform. And Bhagavad Gita is the manual that goes through different steps of development of consciousness. Consciousness means the energy that connects the soul with an object. When we're conscious, consciousness means the energy of perception. I perceive, I see that vase, I'm connected to the vase. And Krishna says here in the second chapter that therefore you should contemplate those objects to which being connected, it will be beneficial for you. Because whatever we contemplate, we have a tendency to explore, to get attached to it, especially if it's something attractive to us, like the opposite sex, or anything in this world. We contemplate it, and then we develop a whole, just like a man sees a woman, or a woman sees a man that they're attracted to, and there's a whole intellectual effort. What can I do? How can I become, what can I say? How can I express myself in such a way? But if I never saw that person, none of that would happen. So therefore, Krishna tries to teach us, if you want perfection and if you want to remember your identity as a spiritual entity, and why would we want to, someone may say, well, I'm kind of happy the way I am. I'm making $80,000 a year and got a nice house, everything's paid off, car, house, and I'm not so bad. I'm healthy. But how long will that last? And my experience is that we see people, and they all smile, and you say, how are you? Great! Everybody says, great, wonderful. Couldn't be better. And one person said that to me, he said, couldn't be better. I said, what a shame. But anyways. But generally, I find people aren't what they express. Because, first of all, we don't know who we are, generally speaking. And even when we do, we're still confused by the presence of the body, which is just, it's just like a filter. Just like if the sun's bright, you put on sunglasses. And the tone, the color, the brightness of the sun is all changed. So to speak, we put on this body when we have the desire to live free or independent of God, we get a body. And then we see things through this body. We identify with things in terms of this body. It's like, a filter. It filters everything. And the body is composed of the body that we see, the mind which we perceive, the intelligence with which we use, and another very subtle aspect of our existence, which is called the false ego. The real ego means that I am a servant of the Supreme. I am a lover and a friend of the Supreme. But the false ego says so many things. I'm an American, I'm white, I'm black, I'm Chinese, I'm a woman, I'm a man. And all these things, according to Bhagavad Gita, are temporary. We get them for so many years, just like you buy a car and it's use it for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, depending on your economic situation. And then at some point you have to give it up. Or we buy some clothing. Bhagavad Gita uses this example. You get some clothing and you like it. This is my favorite shirt, this is my favorite pant, these are my favorite pants. But then it wears out, and you go, I've got to get another one. So that's the same thing that's happening to the body. But we're so closely intertwined with the body that it's much more painful than giving up a shirt. And it's a much more difficult process. So Bhagavad Gita is teaching us to prepare ourselves for that change. And so we see leaving this body, or what people call death. Sometimes when you say death, it has a negative connotation. And rightly so, if we don't know who we are and we don't know what our destiny is and we don't know, you know, what the future will bring, it's like a dark hole that we're just, you know, going into without any understanding. But if we understand it's simply a change, simply I have to change this. This is a lesson in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna's telling Arjuna, he's in anxiety because he's thinking, all my relatives are here and all my friends. And Krishna says to him, they're your relatives now. No. But he says, when you change this body and you take another body, they won't be your relatives, nor will you be their relatives. But that eternal relationship with the Supreme will always exist. And therefore, it recommends that among so many things we may have to do in our lives, with our family, with our friends, with our life, with our education, this thing is the most important thing. This should be our priority. In organizational, managerial teachings, the lesson is set your priorities. You have to establish your priorities. So Bhagavad Gita, the priority is understand my spiritual nature and act on that spiritual nature. So this is just a basic outline or understanding of what this is all about. Because there's volumes and volumes of information. So with that little introduction, I just wanted to see if anybody had a question. About, not necessarily about what I said, but especially you are honored guests. If you could, you know, you might have a question or two about what I said or anything that related. Or anyone.
The armies were five, the Pandava brothers?
Yes, Pandava, five brothers. Oh, I forgot to turn that off. Sorry.
Do you think that was symbolic of five elements?
Unfortunately, there are many people who interpret the Bhagavad Gita, and every number, everything, and they try to make it symbolic. We have a tendency to mystify and to be attracted to mystical, because that which is mystical, we can, and enigmatic, we can try to unlock it by our knowledge, by our exploration, by our meditation. And so some people may interpret it that way. But actually the five Pandavas are five Pandavas. They're actually eternal associates of the Supreme. And what they represent is an ideal character, an ideal relationship with the Supreme, an ideal, demonstrating ideal qualities that we should, you know, that we can aspire for. The mystical approach is called the ascending approach. We ascribe, you know, different meanings and symbols to everything around us, and then we try to discover it. But actually, Bhagavad Gita, descending from the Supreme, ascending from Krishna, is a revelation. So we, you know, there may be many symbolic things. In the Vedas, there are many symbolic stories. Maybe Nityananda can show you one symbolic story in the Bhagavata. It tells about days and nights and, you know, wheels and how they represent days and nights. And so many similar. It's called the story of King Prachinabharishat. And there are many symbolisms. But Bhagavad Gita is a philosophical and spiritual teaching. And so we're more interested in the revelation than trying to discover what symbols or what symbolic meanings may be there. That's our emphasis. that okay, or?
I still think it's symbolic. He also gave the reason for the war being to keep the women pure. For the purity of the women, does this mean the lineage of to keep the family separate?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, that's the first chapter. Arjuna is arguing that if there's a war, then the women, the men will be killed, the women will be unprotected, and they may be exploited. You know, this is something which has happened historically, that after a battle, the victorious army goes in and exploits and loots everything. Anyway, I know there's many people that interpret Bhagavad Gita in that way, symbolically. And there's, but we try to stick to the revelation. That which Krishna is, that's why we call it as it is. Not as we would want it or as we perceive it, but as it is, as Krishna delivered it.
Krishna tells Arjuna, don't worry. Is that the essential message?
Don't worry.
Well, sort of.
At the end, yes, he says, you don't have to worry if you just take shelter of this knowledge, then you'll have no worries.
Take shelter in?
Of the knowledge that I'm giving you. Then you won't have to worry. If you make this your number one priority, and every other aspect of your life, which he calls dharmas, all these different duties and responsibilities, if you govern them by the supreme spiritual responsibility of maintaining a constant reciprocation, loving reciprocation with me, with God, Krishna says, this is the best way to be free from fear and anxiety. That's his last and potent last instruction, which is actually the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita.
Is there a way that you'd like to present the knowledge? I mean, a structured way?
I find Bhagavad Gita very structured.
What I'm asking for is a cheat sheet. For the exam.
Okay. Well, I mean, we have outlines of Bhagavad Gita which are very, condensed. Maybe Nityananda Prabhu can get you one of those, outline study guides, outlines of Bhagavad Gita which, breaks it down in a, helps us understand each section and what it means.
That says every chapter is an acronym,
yes.
A section of
mm-hmm.
the whole Gita is.
Well, for the whole Gita?
Like chapter 9 is K-I-N-G. The first three verses talk about knowledge.
Uh-huh.
The next verses 4 through 10 talk about Krishna's inconceivable devotee, so that's I.
Yeah.
Then verses 11 through 21 talk about non-devotional worship.
Mm-hmm.
And verses 22 through 34 talk about the glories of Bhagavad.
Yeah, so you can give that to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very nice breakdown of you can understand it. Yes.
So we're talking about the five relationships to
uh-huh.
Krishna,
uh-huh.
and I opened the book to page 4 of Bhagavad Gita, and it says, one may be a devotee in a passive state, one may be a devotee in an active state. I was wondering if you could shed some light or explain that.
Mm-hmm. Let's just see if the page numbers are the same. Yes. Well, there are five basic relationships with Krishna, although everyone has a unique relationship. But all the relationships fall into these five basic categories. So passive is called neutrality, technically shantaras. And what that means is that some people just like to admire the Supreme, just be overwhelmed and overjoyed and just meditate on the Supreme. So it's passive, it's more of a meditative, observing, appreciating relationship. And the next relationship, which it says is active, that's called dasya, which is a relationship of servant or service. You're giving service to the Supreme. And the next one is friendship. You actually so intimately related to Krishna or to God that he's like a friend, like someone you can share with directly. Like Arjuna here, in the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna comes to the point where he's been Krishna's friend, he jokes with Krishna, and then when he sees Krishna reveal himself in his splendor, then he becomes overwhelmed. He thinks, Krishna, forgive me, I've been just sitting with you, talking with you, joking with you, and now I realize who you are. As a parent, and finally, so intimate, just like lovers. So this is like progressive intimacy. And with each progression of intimacy, one doesn't even realize that he's God. That's, from friendship on, you don't even see him as God. See him as just my wonderful friend. Just like a small child doesn't relate to his father as father. Necessarily. It's like someone who plays with me, someone who gives me some food. But, he's not like, a little later on he learns some etiquette and, here's my father, I should do this, I shouldn't do that. In the beginning it's just spontaneous dependence.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes.
In this material world, we have this identity. I'm Alex, 42, male,
mm-hmm.
Chandler. And I get this idea that what my body looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this identity, this sense of identity. Now, when we're in the spirit world, we're gonna have. Do we have an identity?
Oh,
if we do, what's the difference between that identity and this identity?
The difference is that our real identity, our eternal identity, is eternal. It doesn't change. It doesn't stop. You don't get older. You don't get sick, you don't die, you're not born. So it's an eternal relationship. There's no defects, there's no, you don't have to shave, you don't have to go to the bathroom and all these encumbrances. No. And eating is just for pleasure. There's no digestion, there's no indigestion or digestion. And so, it's a spiritual identity, spiritual body, but it's perfect.
Now, what will exist in the spirit world? In the spirit world is what we call the subtle body or the atma.
The subtle atma is the spirit, is the soul. Atma means alma or soul, and subtle body means the mind, the intelligence, and the ego. It's part of the material body, but it's subtle. We can't see it, we can't touch it, but we can perceive it. No.
That stays here, right?
Yes, that definitely stays here. No. Yeah, when you go to the spiritual realm, you don't take any baggage. No. Not necessary. No. Just your soul ascends. And not only that, but it matures. Right now, the existence of our soul is like a small seed. And as we develop the propensity and the desire to serve Krishna, to serve the Supreme, then our spiritual identity begins to grow slowly, slowly from that seed. And when that spiritual body is fully developed, then we can leave this world. And we just go with Krishna. And we don't have to wait. That's the good part. We don't have to wait for leaving this body. As soon as our consciousness becomes pure, which means free from material identification, then we can actually be with Krishna. We can be with the Supreme. Because the spiritual world is not some physical place that's, you know, so many kilometers from here, so many miles from here, you know, like 80 billion miles or something, like beyond, you know, such and such constellation, you know, turn left and, you know, put on your GPS, go look at Vrindavan, and the stars. No. But it's not a physical place. It exists all around us. And we can be there right now, sitting right here. No. Just like Srila Prabhupada, he was always with Krishna. He came here and you know, he had to leave somewhere. But he's actually, his consciousness is full. When your consciousness is fully absorbed in the Supreme, in Krishna, then you're there. No.
Is it kind of like in the Bible, Luke 17:21, it says that the kingdom of God is within us. Hmm? The kingdom of God is within us.
Yeah. And also Christ said, I am within this world, but I'm not of this world. No. So, that's, you know, that's what the Vedas teach us, that we don't, as soon as you stop identifying with this world and with worldly existence, then you can identify with the real existence, spiritual existence, then you're there. And you have a duty to perform here. Just like in our mind, we can be in Paris or in London in a second. But it's not exactly the same because we're not really there. We're thinking of it, so we're partially there. But when you actually learn to meditate on Krishna, because he's non-material, and when your meditation becomes pure and potent, then you're actually there, and you're just functioning here. And even though the body may experience and the mind may experience different things, different interferences, you don't take it very seriously. You may take it seriously, meaning that I get sick, I have to do something about it, but it's not the most important thing. It's a functional existence in this world. Yes.
It's maybe more of a comment.
Yes.
Because I came in halfway through when you were discussing about the friendship and relationships with Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, it got me thinking, you know, in this world, sometimes people are just friends with another person because there's something for them to gain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one else likes TV games the way I do, but you do, so let's be friends. Or
yeah.
It's not like that?
No, actually our friendship in this world is generally based on some common interest, like you said. But friendship with Krishna is based on a pure, loving relationship. That friendship is very special. It never decreases. It's not dependent on any condition. Of course, it does contain that element. No. And the element is we like what Krishna likes. Just like there's a tendency in this world, which is a reflection of that. When you see something of someone that's very qualified, someone you admire, then you find out what do they do, what do they like, what do they like to do. And sometimes we try to emulate that or to, you know, identify with that. So when we find a supremely attractive person, and we also understand that that person is the source of our very existence, then our friendship develops on the basis, of course Krishna says this in the fifth chapter at the end. He says, when you understand that because everything emanates from me, everything ultimately rests in me, and therefore when you offer everything to me, you know, make everything an offering to me, not that you physically offer to him, but you're conscious of him, whatever you do, whatever, like I said, expenditure of energy is offered to Krishna. And then you understand he's the owner of everything, and therefore I'm, just like if I were a servant in someone's house, I can enjoy all the facilities, but I can't take them home with me. No. And so, if we understand that everything belongs to Krishna, meaning that everything should be used in some way or another to further his desire, and then you understand he's your best friend, then you can actually be peaceful, you know, and serene, and happy. But as long as we think that this is my couch, or this is my building, then that immediately, as soon as you own something in this world, it creates some degree of anxiety. And therefore Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Nir Yoga Kshema Atmavan, better not to acquire anything unnecessary, just the bare necessities, because it's difficult. And it's more difficult to preserve it, and it's ultimately more difficult to give it up. Become very attached to our, you know, items. When I was in the airport the other day, they have these screens all over the place, and one person on some channel was saying, you know, why do we have so much stuff? He was saying people have so many things in their houses, you know, they may not use them for 20 years or something. Just keep acquiring more and more stuff. And then you have to have a bigger house. I remember our lawyer in Costa Rica, he had two houses. He had his big house and a small house. And the small house was just full of all the things that he wasn't using. So you acquire so many things, and then to maintain them, it's taxing. So Krishna recommends that. Just have what you need, you know, and try to understand what you really need. Because we think we need so many things. Like in the airplanes, they have Sky Mall, you know, and I see people flipping through, you know, you need this special pancake flipper. No, this one you'll never fail in flipping your pancakes. And then they have these advertisements. Call today and you get this, and you get that, and you need this. So we're always, I have to have one of those. But if we really understand what we need to live a healthy life and to live peacefully, what I really need, then life becomes very simple. Mahatma Gandhi said, if everyone tries to get what they want, there's not enough in the universe for one person. But if everybody tries to get what they need, then there's enough for everybody. And generally, we're in the first category. And therefore, there's competition in this world. We're all trying, you know, we're all trying to reap the same resources, and you know, and therefore there's borders and skirmishes and disputes, you know. even in marriage, you know, people separate. No, this is my house. No, it's my house. No, this is my money. No, it's my money. And so, you know, all these because of possessiveness.
Arguing over possessions is one thing, but what about arguing over conversations? You who has the right to speak, and who gets the last word, who understands, who doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
What about conflicts like that?
Well, I think Bhagavad Gita is an ideal example of conversation. That Arjuna approaches Krishna because Krishna has something very valuable to say. And he asks questions, and Krishna answers the questions. Just like in the school or university, a student approaches the professor and asks questions. Otherwise, just two people talking, and who's going to figure out who says what and when, and like you say, who gets the last word. Sometimes that's a battle of the egos. So when people are actually, what we recommend is that we try to develop the attitude of a servant. If everyone sees the other person as someone to be served, as in the Bible it says, better to give than receive. And the same principle is there in Bhagavad Gita and in the Vedas. If we have the attitude of giving and serving, then we want to hear what other people have to say. And we want to, we have some humility that we can listen and be with empathy, and with concern, with care. And when we speak, we do it with compassion and friendship, not trying to, dominate the other person or show them we're more intelligent or something like that, but trying to give something. And especially if we take knowledge from the Supreme, then we're transmitting. We're receiving and we're transmitting. So it becomes free from that egoistic principle of being the best philosopher or the best conversationalist.
When I started learning about Ahankara, the false ego, and the mind, and the intellect, I started catching myself, I caught myself, acting from the ego.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta prove somebody wrong. I gotta, and once I was aware of that, I better stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I still do it.
Yeah, that's, Bhagavad Gita reveals these things so that we can, transcend them, surpass them.
Yeah, go beyond that, because that's what it is, when somebody has to prove somebody wrong, or even when they feel more or less. It is the ego that thinks that, that feels that. But, when I became more aware of that,
mm-hmm.
It did change my attitude somehow.
Well, actually, spiritual advancement or spiritual understanding is about attitude. Attitude really means what is our motivation in what we do and what we say. So it means being free from motivations that are stimulated by ego and being motivated by the inspiration that descends from Krishna and his servants. So I think it may be time for the next phase of the program.
Could I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
You were speaking about Goloka Vrindavan and how we could actually be there right now. Is that the moments that we are thinking of Krishna and chanting, or is it a formal invitation that we're actually, our spiritual master has brought us there?
It begins with a theoretical understanding. And if we chant Hare Krishna, which we're going to do now, then yes, we may be approaching that plane, and we may be there momentarily. We may get a glimpse, have spiritual practices, and the more we become situated on that path. And then we come to the point where we're there and we're functioning. That's all.
And
that's a very advanced stage. It's not like after 2 weeks and I'll be...
But you're awake with your relationship with your spiritual master. That one is...
Yeah, the spiritual master is guiding us to that level of consciousness. That's the purpose of the spiritual master, to bring us to that plane. Spiritual master means like teacher, spiritual teacher. So we'll chant again. And now that we have maybe a little bit more understanding, when we chant, one person leads and the others respond. And this is like in the same mood of service. We're chanting, and trying to give others the benefit of the holy name, and then we receive it from others. So this is the spiritual interchange between us.